literacy education gadfly show. Mike and Rick tell you everything you need to know about education and learning and teaching. Listen to the words that they be preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show, yeah.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, a man who endured fits of laughter during the Margaret Spellings interview on The Daily Show, Rick Hess.
Hey, big guy.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing good.
Good. You watch The Daily Show?
I do, although it's funny. I got to admit, I had a long week, so I fell asleep during the John Stewart lead-in stuff and didn't get a chance to see the appearance of the secretary.
Well, you can watch the clip online.
How good is it?
Actually, I haven't watched it yet either.
Jen?
It was okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. He went easy on her.
Did she bring her A-game?
Someone else suggested that it's possible that he was trying to, like, lure other government people in, so he was very nice to
her. Or maybe he just, maybe he was a little digging on her.
Also possible. She did look good. She looked good.
Mm-hmm. Now, conspiracy theories abound, indeed, about why John Stewart, why, I don't know, say Chairman Miller and other people have been so nice to Margaret Spellings lately. It makes you wonder.
Are you suggesting she's running guns?
Not suggesting she's running guns.
John Stewart's a gun collector and she's giving guns?
I'm saying, look, why are everybody being so nice to Margaret Spellings? I mean, you know, she goes
What's
in
the
front.
What's theory, though? Like,
well, look, she goes in front of Chairman Miller to talk about reading first and student loans. He does have a very tough opening statement, but spends most of the time talking about student loans, doesn't get to much on reading first. Nobody asks her the question, you know, Secretary Spellings, what was your role in the Reading First program? And I'm just amazed that they don't, you know, they just want to allow the press and government to go after some mid-level official instead of going after Big Kahuna. And I don't know. I just think the question needs to be asked, why is that?
Mike, so you're not turning into Ahab on us, are you, baby?
No, I'm not usually a conspiracy theorist kind of guy, but this is red meat stuff. I figured the Democrats would be beating her up all over the place, but they're not, and I want to know why. All right. Well, hey, and Rick had a big conference this week. Went well.
Woohoo!
300 people to talk about education research.
Can you imagine? Hey, you gotta like. Although I gotta say, AERA still had us beat by a factor of about 50-1.
Yeah,
I think they pulled 15,000 in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, that's an unfair comparison.
That's what I'm saying.
All right, listeners.
I'm just a man.
Rick is just a man, and. What was that? What does that mean?
I don't know. Just AERA is a machine, and I'm one. It's like when John – remember John Henry tried to dig through the mountain ahead, you know, against the locomotive, and it nearly killed him? I don't want to kill myself trying to outdo AERA.
You're not just a man. You have the Hestapo, as Andy Rotherham said. The whole team of Rick Hess minions.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm crazy about the background images of that one. You take what you take.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get going. We're going to start, of course, with a game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we have an interview with one of the presenters at your conference, University of Washington Professor Dan Goldhaber. And then in-house weirdo Liam will, of course, impart some education news of the weird. So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Jen, kick us off.
All right. Topic one. Rick, candidate Hillary Clinton wants $10 billion for national pre-K. Is this a good idea?
Maybe.
Rick, are you going to play this mamby-pamby research thing again? Come on, have an opinion.
That's like somebody says to me, Rick, somebody wants to put $30 billion into K-12. Is it a good idea? Maybe. I mean, what are you going to do with it? I mean, what are the do we have the details on the Clinton plan? Because I got to admit, I haven't seen them.
We've seen some information. Liam maybe can fill in here too because he's written a nice piece for the Gadfly about it. But you know, basically, $5 billion in the first year, ramped up to $10 billion. She wants the pre-K teachers to have bachelor's degrees. Liam, tell me if I'm wrong. I think she doesn't necessarily say that it has to be a particular provider; that it can be a mix of providers providing the pre-K. Is that fair? Yeah, and this is targeted to low-income kids. And it's basically providing a match to the states.
I mean, the notion that you should have a bachelor's degree is hardly a runaway crazy case of credential inflation. As long as you're leaving this thing open to private providers and you're letting public and private compete on equal footing, that's not unreasonable. And the notion that, we ought to be incenting states to try to come up with creative ways to help, offer pre-K to more low-income kids. Not an unreasonable policy.
Well, there you go. Rick Hess has an opinion.
There you go, baby. But I like to know what the hell I'm having an opinion on before I utter it.
Well, that's why, you know, this plan came out a couple days ago. You could have looked at it.
Dude, I don't keep up with every new initiative thrown in the Daily Press. Rick. I'm not a pundit.
I don't know. You're a pundit. I think you can't deny. I mean, what do you, Jen, Rick, don't you think Rick qualifies as a pundit?
Yeah.
Does that mean I have, like, pundit obligations to, like, be up to the minute on each new proposal?
At least up to the day.
Damn it.
Yes.
Darn it.
Okay, Jen, second topic.
Damn it.
All right. Topic two. LA's mayor has given up his school takeover bid, satisfied that he's winning a majority on the school board.
What's the mayor's name again, Jen?
Come on, Mike. Go for it, baby. You like saying this.
Okay. Are you referring to Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa?
That would be it. I wasn't going to try it because I didn't want to be mocked if I got it wrong. So I'll leave that to you. All right. So anyway, he's given up his school takeover bid, satisfied that he's winning a majority on the school board. Is this a capitulation or savvy politics?
All right. So it's a little bit of both, although I think it's a capitulation. I mean, you know, I can understand at this point he decided that his school reform takeover bid – which had been caught up in the courts. He received a negative court opinion. He could have appealed and kept fighting the fight, but it looks like it might be pretty much dead. He decided to give up on it because he now has control of the school board. And he says, look, I don't need to run the schools anymore. I've got my people on the school board. And look at the great dialogue we've had over the past year because of this big fight. Now, it does make you wonder, was this his strategy all along or was it not? You know, there's a New Yorker piece that basically lays out the argument that he's decided that education is really hard and might hurt his political future, and so he might try to now pivot and move on to greener pastures.
He'd already lost on the school board thing. Even the plan that they finally got assembled last year.
The takeover.
The takeover was such an awkward contraption that, frankly, it was hard to see how that was going to work for him.
Yeah.
So, in that sense, he'd already lost. This actually works well for him. He gets to say no longer necessary. And, from his perspective, it's a win-win. One, he's got a school board that'll do the things he'd like to see it do. And two, he actually has, some plausible deniability. Mm-hmm. So if these things don't go well, it doesn't damage his candidacy for governor in a couple of years.
Right. Although I think it's an open question about whether the school board will do his bidding. I mean, they don't officially report to him. I mean, he's helped them out. But we've seen in other cases where people get into office and they go their own way.
Indeed. But I got to say, actually, from his perspective, in just terms of maintaining viability, having a board that he can say, geez, these idiots didn't listen to me, is far from the worst thing in the world.
Yeah, politically. Maybe not so good for the kids in Los Angeles.
Oh, Rick. Mike, these issues are complicated.
Okay, Jen.
All right. Ooh. Okay.
Whoa, that was quick.
Yeah.
Topic's over.
Just
moving on.
Two minutes flew by.
All right. A new evaluation of the DC voucher program finds some very satisfied parents. News on student achievement results is due out this summer. But regardless of what the achievement results say, is customer satisfaction enough?
No. I mean, this is something that we've been beating up on traditional district schools forever, that we know most Americans like the schools in their neighborhood. They like the schools in their community. They like the school their oldest child attends. And we say, look, it doesn't matter if you like the school. Part of what matters is how effectively that school is educating your kid.
Well, Rick, I agree wholeheartedly, but I have to admit, I expect you to take the other position. I mean, I heard you just say the other day that even if evaluations come out and show school choice to be ineffective, that you would still support it because you just believe in choice and freedom.
Well, I believe in markets. Right? I mean, the argument for choice isn't the notion that the handful of schools that the kids getting vouchers are moving into in D.C. today happen to be delivering better reading and math instruction, grades 3 to 8.
Right.
The argument is that markets create opportunities for people who otherwise would be blocked out, the Steve Barrs and the David Levins of the world, to come in and figure out better and more effective ways to deliver instruction. And frankly, you need the kinds of opportunities that charters and vouchers create in order to make sure that you've got that process.
Okay. But by that argument, the D.C. program, the voucher program, doesn't really create much of a market.
That's right.
I mean, it's limited, 2,000 kids, which is very small. The tuition amount is fairly healthy, though certainly not as strong as the amount of money for charter schools. So the dynamism in D.C. is really around the charter school market, not around the voucher program.
That's exactly right. And I think, in D.C., charters show us, what you'd expect in any, what you get in Milwaukee, too,
yeah,
is that you create an opportunity for some outstanding schools, but you know, no one should expect that everybody who comes to play is necessarily going to be good or competent. And that's why weeding out is so important. And that's why parental satisfaction is, of course, important and significant.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the question was, you know, is consumer satisfaction enough? And the answer's got to be heck no.
Those libertarians are going to come after you now, right?
That's okay.
Yeah, good. Bring them on, huh?
Yeah, baby.
All righty. That is it for Pardon the Gadfly. Let's now turn to our interview of the week. With us today on the show is Dr. Daniel Goldhaber, an associate research professor at the University of Washington Center for Reinventing Public Education, what we like to call CREEPY. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Mike.
Well, we're going to talk today, Dan, about the research conference that our host, Rick Hess, held the other day at AEI about the politics of research, politics of knowledge. You had a paper that kind of wound up the conference looking at incentives for researchers and how they may go astray. So tell us quickly here, you know, what do you think? Why is it that there aren't enough good incentives in place for education researchers to do good work?
Well, you know, I'm sort of an outcomes guy, and I think that when you look at education policy today, that there's some real striking examples of where policy doesn't seem to have been well informed from research. So I guess I reached that conclusion by looking at what we actually see going on in the world.
Right. So, you know, I heard you say that the class size is a great example. Tell me about that.
Well, the research on class size is pretty definitive in showing that it makes a difference for certain kinds of kids, disadvantaged and minority kids in the early grades. But if you look at the way that it's been applied, it's been applied in a lot of places sort of across all elementary schools and without the kind of nuances that would make it a cost-effective investment.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, California takes that research and just does.
California's a very good example.
Yeah, class size across
billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you lay that at the feet of the researchers, Dan, or the policymakers, or how to think about that?
Well, I think there are probably a lot of very complicated causes. But part of the problem is, in my mind, and I should mention that this is a paper that I did with Dominic Brewer, so our mind, is that there's a lot of research out there. There's good, there's bad, and it's really hard to tell the difference from the good from the bad. And so it's easy to latch on to research to support whatever particular policy position you have.
Right, but in this particular case, the class size research was pretty good.
That's right. The class size research is pretty good, but the way it's been translated and the way a lot of policymakers, I don't know whether it's that they understand it that way or it's the way they promote it, is that class size reduction is good without some of the important nuances about who it really affects.
So any thoughts on whose job is it to try to make sure those nuances are, you know, part of the conversation? And are there any ways to go about doing that?
Well, I certainly think that researchers bear some of the responsibility. I think that it's important that they're clear about their findings and to the extent that it's possible when they see their research out there being promoted in ways that are inconsistent with what it actually says, that they make efforts to correct the record. But we also talked a little at the conference about intermediaries and the role of the intermediaries. And there are definitely intermediaries who push a particular agenda, and sometimes that agenda is inconsistent with the weight of the research. And honestly, the consumers of the research certainly bear some responsibility. So I think that policymakers, when making important decisions that affect children and the expenditure of billions of dollars, they really should try and get it right.
Now, Dan, you served on a school board for two terms in Alexandria, Virginia. So now, did that mean after the conference you went home and you beat yourself upside the head a little bit for having failed as a policymaker?
Well, to be honest, I actually think of myself as being having been a pretty ineffectual school board member.
Is there any other kind, Dan?
Well,
is there a correlation between that?
There's probably a range of ineffectual, and I was on the downside of that range. But, you know, it's amazing how anecdotes carry the day. And I'm not sure what the real answer is to that. But I found time and time again that in what a particular board member felt about, you know, what his or her children were doing in school seemed to have carry a lot more weight than the research evidence on a particular issue.
So were you ineffectual because you tried to pay attention to the research?
Oh, I think I just was not a particularly good politician. There are a variety of reasons that I was ineffectual.
So one last question here, Dan. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the field of education research going forward?
Here's how I phrased it at the conference. I said, I think that it's probably the best of times in terms of the quality of research and the likelihood that research affects policy, but the best of times is pretty bad. So I'm not terribly optimistic, but I think some of the things that we talked about at the conference, like better quality control gatekeepers, a real good quality journal in education, some of the things that IES is doing, the Institute for Education Sciences, that they will lead to better research and better implementation of research going forward.
Okay. Well, thanks for your insights. Again, Dr. Dan Goldilocks Goldhaber.
Ooh.
Do you like that?
I like that, baby.
I love it.
You love it, too. All right. From the University of Washington, Dan, thanks so much for coming on the show. Dan's also a listener, you know, and he, for one, told me that he likes the rap.
I still haven't heard this rap.
I do, but Mike, I've got to tell you that I'd be more impressed if it were you and Rick that were actually the ones rapping.
Well, everybody thinks we're the ones rapping anyway, so maybe we'll give it a try. All right, Dan, thanks for coming on the show.
All right, take care.
Hey, bye, big guy.
So, now, Rick, don't you think that Dan looks a little bit like that guy that was on Friends, at the end of Friends, the guy who was Phoebe's husband, you know, boyfriend, and then they eventually got married? They kind of look alike, don't you think, now that Dan's growing out his hair?
You know, Dan growing out his hair, it's different. I'm so used to being so cut so short.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's interesting is William Howell has cut his hair short. So I was thrown a little bit.
You know, maybe maybe we can put some pictures up of Dan and William Howell on our website so people can see this.
William's hair used to kind of fall into his eyes, and it would bounce when he was giving a presentation, and now his hair is shorter.
Yeah.
So it's all it's all.
Well, this
confusing.
Makes sense because William went to the University of Chicago, mm-hmm. which is known to be a fairly staid place, and Dan went to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow Jen doesn't think this conversation is relevant. Education policy. I don't know why not.
I don't know.
I'm telling you, look at some of the old Friends reruns. The guy who was dating Phoebe, then they got married, looks a lot like Dan Goldhaber.
Oh, now Liam's handed me a note. He just wanted me to clarify this. He says, listeners who get confused should understand that this week's interview was with Dan Goldhaber, who should not be confused with Ari Goldfinger, the Bond villain who cheats at gin rummy and employs a Korean manservant. Oh. So I think just listeners ought to be careful.
Yes. Yes.
To make sure they don't get confused.
And, which, by the way, that other guy doesn't look anything like the guy on Friends.
Well said.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, it is time for everyone's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian, full of so much good information this week, it looks like. Liam, what is weird this week?
A panel speaker at Boulder High School in Boulder, Colorado, told the audience of teenagers to have sex and do drugs. Quote.
No.
Quote. I'm going to encourage you to have sex, and I'm going to encourage you to use drugs appropriately, said Joel Becker, a Los Angeles psychologist. And why I'm going to take that position is because you're going to do it anyway. Parent Priscilla White disagrees, and she complained about Becker's statements to the school board.
Only one parent complained?
Goldhaber would have been okay with this one on the board.
Apparently, White doesn't think it's appropriate for high schools to sponsor panels that push drug use and tout premarital intercourse. School board president Helene Jones wasn't amused with White's antics, however. At one point, she told White to stop reading excerpts from the panel discussion because the language was inappropriate. Rick, if you were invited to give an educational presentation to a group of high school students, what would it be about?
Leah, man, that was stellar. This is why Villaraigosa doesn't actually want the LA schools too close.
No, that's right.
That's just not good for you.
This is another argument for mayoral control.
In LA, I wonder if this guy has any relationship to LAUSD, this LA psychologist.
Wow.
Wow. I got to say, so you know, if the critique, though, is premarital sex, I think my talk to a high school class would be, if you're going to start having sex in high school, make sure you get married first. because that at least addresses the premarital sex problem.
All right. But isn't there an old, you know, saying that a lot of conservatives like to tout that if you want to not be poor, the key thing is to like get to 20 without having a baby or getting married and not dropping out of high school.
Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly right. Yeah. But so that was really just a limited response. I was just saying, if somebody asked, how do you fight premarital sex? In that context, one way is to encourage them to rush off and get married.
I'm not
necessarily sure that it's a
– maybe arranged marriages.
Huh? Mm. I mean I'm not sure in the macro scheme of things that it's probably the optimal course of activity.
Well, that is weird, Liam. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. And I think that is all the time we have for this week.
Huh.
I understand, Rick, that you're
fancy that.
Fancy that.
So, time has passed.
Time has passed. Rick is off to, I understand, a happy hour with some of the education literati here.
Well, first, D.C. We've I think Brookings, actually, they're doing some executive education. I'm going to go do some presentation or other for them.
Oh.
And got to figure this out.
Well, good. See, that makes you a pundit. There you have.
Really?
Yeah.
Executive education?
Yeah, you're an expert.
It's like academic. It's scholarly.
If you call Brookings scholarly.
Oof. You're dissing on Brookings?
I'm just saying they're a think tank.
I wonder if we could call up Tom Lovelace. He can be like, wah, 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 wah.
Yes, we should bring that.
Wah, wah, wah.
All right. Now we have definitely gone over time. Mm. But readers, don't forget, listeners, don't forget to read the Education Gadfly. I mean, your listeners and your readers. That's what we hope. We hope you listen to the podcast. Okay, everybody's telling me just to get off. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Finally, signing off.